This is the last chapter in the unit, and so it reminds me to remind you that when you come Monday, make sure you have a green Scantron form in hand, because I won't have any to give you if you forget. You'll have to bum one from one of your classmates if you forget. So if you haven't already, make a trip to the bookstore and get a pack of six, I think they sell them as. The green ones, they'll know what you're talking about. This final chapter is called something like Carbon and the Molecular Diversity of Life. Or no, is that right? I don't remember the title. Anyway, it's about carbon and the importance of carbon. But this opening slide is a cartoon of the experimental glassware apparatus that was set up for a famous experiment first occurring in the 50s. It's been redone since with even better results. But it was first done in the 50s by Miller and Urey. It's the Miller-Urey experiment, but you don't have to remember the name. It was an experiment, though, to demonstrate that the building blocks that all organisms are made out of, which didn't exist on early Earth before there was any life, could easily have been produced over time, just given the Earth's conditions at the time. One thing that you need to get a perspective of is that there was almost a billion years of Earth history before there was any life. 800 million years or so of what is called the Hadean Eon, Hadean meaning hell-like, because it's really hot. Completely different place than it is now. But lifeless. There were no cells, no organisms. This gets back to what we keep repeating about cell theory, that cells come from pre-existing cells, right? They don't just pop into existence anymore, and it's been that way for billions of years. They come only from cells that already exist, but obviously that can't have always been true. There had to have been some original cells that did come from things that weren't cells, that just came from the molecules that make up cells. And those molecules include small run-of-the-mill molecules like water and so on, but also includes these four kinds of macromolecules that I keep talking about: polysaccharides, nucleic acids, proteins, and lipids. So unless you have those four macromolecule types already in place on Earth, you can't really imagine a situation in which the first cells formed that are the ancestors to all living things, that they're the trunk of life, right? Those original successful cells. So this, we knew that the, or we suspect that these relatively complex organic compounds didn't exist already on Earth, but the experiment demonstrated that they would have come to exist just for ordinary chemical reasons based on early Earth's history. And this is not the only, this doesn't say this is the only way this could have happened. There, molecules could be brought in from outer space as well on comets or whatever. There's all kinds of possibilities for how organic molecules could have gotten here to be the precursors to the first cells. And you'll learn more about this in 182, but this experimental setup mimics the early Earth oceans, hot as hell, with simple chemicals in them. It's not just pure water. There's simple things like methane that we knew existed. And you just keep running this thing. Now remember, the real experiment, Earth itself, ran this experiment for 800 million years, which is inconceivably a long time from our point of view. You think that 100 years is a long time. Well, that's almost zero compared to 800 million years. But you don't have to run this experiment that represents Earth very long, just a couple weeks. And what you'll notice,
well, the atmosphere bulb here is fitted with electrodes
so that they could spark it every once in a while to mimic lightning. And if you do that for a couple weeks and then take samples, you'll notice that there are more complex chemicals. The organic compounds that organisms are made out of. And when they did it in the 50s, they got almost all of the amino acids that organisms build their proteins out of. That when they redid it with better conditions in the 2000s, I think, they got more than all of the amino acids that organisms use. So that's the point of that. But I've used the word organic, and before, even though I've switched it to, before I actually get to what's on there, let me talk about this word organic for a second. Organic is used different ways depending on who's using it. For instance, when it's used with respect to food at grocery stores or whatever on labels, it ranges from meaningless to meaningful depending on how they actually define organic. But anything that's any of those uses of the word organic is totally different from the chemical definition of organic. Organic is a chemical term. Now, historically speaking, until fairly recently, throughout human history, we thought, as it turned out incorrectly, that the stuff that non-living things are made out of is fundamentally different from the stuff that living things are made out of, organisms are made out of. And so that's why we call the stuff that organisms are made out of organic material. That's where the word came from. Okay, it's stuff of organisms. But we thought it's impossible to make any of this stuff out of stuff that's non-living. To make organic compounds, you have to get it from some organism. We were wrong about that, and nowadays we can easily synthesize organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. But that's why we made the distinction. So the definition has kind of changed a little bit, and it's still not a completely satisfying, clear-cut definition. But in chemistry, organic does mean carbon-containing. You might have heard that before. But that's not enough of a definition. And that's because the thing you're writing with, if you're using a pencil, we call that stuff lead. Nowadays it has nothing to do with the element lead. It's graphite, which is one form of pure carbon. It's nothing but carbon atoms. Even though there's nothing but carbon in graphite, it is not considered organic. Neither is diamond, another form of pure carbon. More expensive version. Still, it's nothing but carbon atoms, though. So pure carbon is not organic. Organic means containing carbon, but in a compound. So there has to be other things as well. And that still has exceptions. So the vast majority of carbon-containing compounds are organic. But there are some things that we still say are not, and it's mostly for historical reasons, we say they are not organic, including carbon dioxide. That's the important exception in this course. Carbon dioxide is a carbon-containing compound, right? But it is not organic. Almost all the other carbon-containing compounds, meaning carbon with other things, and almost always there's hydrogen in there, sometimes there's oxygen, nitrogen, and so on. All of those things are organic. Now, the three different compounds that we see in slide 2 are not only organic, but they are more specifically examples of hydrocarbons. These are all hydrocarbons. All hydrocarbons are organic, but not all organic molecules are hydrocarbons. It's just a subset of organic molecules or compounds. What makes something a hydrocarbon? Well, the name gives that away. It's a compound that is made up of only carbon and hydrogen, nothing else, which you can see is true for all three of these examples if you look at the ball and stick models. Just black and white balls. Right? Now, don't confuse, by the way, the word hydrocarbon and the word carbohydrate. Carbohydrate also seems like it's only carbon and hydrogen, but Carbohydrates, as we'll talk more about later, contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. They are not hydrocarbons. The simplest hydrocarbon is methane, and you built that with the ball and stick model. Hydrocarbons in general make excellent fuels. They contain a lot of usable energy in their bonds, and we'll be talking more about that in Unit 3, but you see this in gasoline, for instance, which we are sadly still using. It's really just a mixture of a bunch of different hydrocarbons because they make excellent fuels. Well, that's true not only in internal combustion engines, it's also true in organisms' bodies, in your cells. You use things that contain carbon-hydrogen bonds for fuel all the time. And we'll talk more about why carbon-hydrogen bonds are good sources of energy, and that's all you really have. Well, you have carbon-carbon bonds and carbon-hydrogen bonds in hydrocarbons, but those carbon-hydrogen bonds are really important. We'll say why for energetic reasons later, but while we're at the topic, let me say that carbon-hydrogen bonds are also nonpolar. So hydrocarbons as molecules are nonpolar. Now, what is it that explains that a CH bond is nonpolar? What has to be true for it to be nonpolar? What do you mean by equal? Equal geometry? Equal octopus? That's not what's equal. What is equal about it? Equal sharing of the pair of electrons between the two atoms. And what, in turn, is the reason why there is equal sharing? What about electronegativity?
They have similar levels.
Right. The two involved atoms have more or less the same value for electronegativity. There's not a big difference, like there is between the electronegativity of oxygen and that of hydrogen, which makes an OH bond polar, like in water. So C and H, not exactly the same electronegativity values, but very close. So the sharing is more or less equal. They make non-polar covalent bonds. And this is why hydrocarbons don't mix well with water, because water is polar. Polar things like to be around other polar things. Nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things. The two don't mix well, though, which itself is important to life, and we'll talk more about that in after the upcoming test. These, though, are all hydrocarbons. Now, what is the big deal about carbon? You know, I've said it's the basis for organic compounds. Well, chemistry as a science is immense. It's a huge science, just like biology is huge. As huge as it is, it's split into two pieces, really, both of which are still huge. But it shows you the importance of carbon. All of chemistry is broken into organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry. The chemistry of organic compounds versus the chemistry of inorganic compounds. So chemistry has an importance. And that importance comes from its valence. As you can see in slide 3, we're looking at the four major nonmetals that organisms are made out of, right? Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen are make up the bulk of any given organism, not just humans. But we've talked about valence. Remember that valence is how many more electrons that an atom needs in order to fill its valence subshell. In the case of carbon, that valence is 4, right? The number of valence electrons is 4, coincidentally, but the valence is also 4, which is why it's 4 steps from the right edge. And in terms of ball and stick models, that means carbon has 4 holes, right? Meaning that it needs to make 4 overall bonds in any molecule it's part of. Well, one word that we use to talk about that is tetravalence. Tetra simply means 4. So
Carbon is a tetravalent atom.
Oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen are not. They have lower valences. But if you look at the periodic table, you should be able to tell that carbon is not the only tetravalent element. What are the other ones? Silicon, germanium, anything in that same group as carbon, right, has the same valence. Now, if I were to ask a kindergartner what is special about C in that column, what would the kindergartner say? Trying to get you to not overthink this. What is special about carbon in the tetravalent group? It's the top one, which means it's the smallest one. So carbon is the smallest tetravalent atom. And that is why life is based on it. It's the smallest one. But why is tetravalent such a big deal? Because it allows for a lot more variety of compounds. Hydrogen has a valence of one, right? So in any molecule it's part of, it's simply making one bond. The only variety it has really is that it can make a bond with any other nonmetal. So it can change what it is making a bond with, but that's it. It's always going to be making one bond. Carbon, on the other hand, has to make four bonds. So it can do that by making four single bonds. It can form two double bonds that add up to four. It can form a triple bond and a single bond. That alone is a lot more variety than these others, right? Plus you have the fact that if you're making four single bonds, it can be four of the same thing that you're connecting to, like four hydrogens in methane. Two of one and two of another, three of one, and there's all kinds of possibilities just with single bonds, right? Then you get into double and triple bonds. So there's the most variety of ways to combine with other nonmetals to make make molecules with tetravalence, with carbon. And that's its specialness to life. And that's why there are so many organic compounds. Carbon is very versatile. Slide 4 is a structural formula of urea, which is an organic compound. This one is, there's two things I'll mention about this. They're unrelated to each other, but in almost all organic compounds, you have at least one carbon-hydrogen bond somewhere. This is an example of one that doesn't. There's hydrogen in the molecule, notice, but the carbon isn't directly connected to the hydrogen, which is kind of unusual. But this is considered organic. The main reason it's up here, though, is for historical reasons. I told you that we thought for a long time that organic molecules come only from organisms and it's impossible to produce them with non-living stuff. Well, urea proved us wrong. Urea was the first substance that was successfully synthesized from inorganic stuff to make something that is just like what organisms produce, but not involving any organism at all. Now it's pretty routine to make organic compounds, but it's historically significant. That brings us to 5. And in 5, we have a bunch more examples of hydrocarbons. Do you recognize these all as hydrocarbons? There's nothing here but carbons and hydrogens, right? And what we see here in A, B, C, and D is that there are different ways, more than just the four shown here, but there are different ways to classify hydrocarbons that are fundamentally different, meaning the way you classify that A has nothing to do with B or C or D. There are different ways of classifying them. One way, though, is simply by the length of what is called the carbon skeleton. Notice that each of these molecules has however many carbons are involved highlighted in teal or whatever color this is. However many carbons are in an organic compound makes up what we call the carbon skeleton. You can think of an organic compound as the carbon skeleton plus everything that's connected to it, all the other non-carbon atoms. In the case of a hydrocarbon, all those non-carbon atoms are hydrogen by definition. But that's one thing that makes different hydrocarbons different substances that contain different numbers of carbon, possibly, like ethane and propane. Notice those both end in A-N-E, because they are both examples of a category of hydrocarbons called alkanes, also which ends in A-N-E. So alkane is not a specific substance. It is a category of hydrocarbons. Alkanes are hydrocarbons that contain only single bonds. And individual alkanes are called something that ends in A-N-E to remind us that they're alkanes. The eth part means two. Meth means one. Methane is also an alkane, right? No, only single bonds. Meth means one. Eth means two. Prop means three. Bute means four, like in butane, and so on. So that's one way. The size of the carbon skeleton, length. Double bonds is another one. Notice these are butene, not butane. They are examples of alkenes. Alkenes are hydrocarbons that have at least one double bond. But bute, once again, means four. Like I said, it does for butane. It's four carbons, but there's at least one double bond. Well, in this case, notice that there's two possible positions for that double bond. It can be right in the middle or off to one side, and it doesn't matter which side it's off to, it would be the same thing. So you have one butene and two butene. These are different substances, even though they have exactly the same chemical formula. They have exactly the same number of carbons and hydrogens as each other. And therefore, they are examples of isomers. Iso means same. Two isomers are isomers because they have the same chemical formula, but the arrangement of the atoms is different in some respect, so they are not the same substance. And that's why you don't get all the needed information necessarily if you just look at a chemical formula, right? Because notice there's eight hydrogens here in both of these. So it would be C4H8. That's the chemical formula for both of these. You can't tell just from that chemical formula which one it's talking about. H2O, yes, you know that's water, but you don't necessarily know just from a chemical formula what you're talking about because there are isomers. Branching is another way of categorizing these hydrocarbons. Branching of the carbon skeleton, that is. So butane has four, this is the four-carbon alkane that I was talking about, butane, has four carbons, but so does methylpropane. The difference is that butane has a linear arrangement of in the carbon skeleton, and this one has a branched arrangement. Now, if you have four carbons exactly, then those are the only two possible branching configurations. But if you each time you add another carbon, there become many more branching possibilities. So when you get to high numbers of carbons, there are really a lot of different isomers that have exactly the same chemical formula. A lot of hydrocarbon isomers. Then the fourth one is based on whether or not the carbon skeleton comes back and bonds to itself to form a ring, which happens in cyclohexane and benzene, for instance, but not in all hydrocarbons, obviously. The rest of them don't have rings. So these are just ways of classifying them, but they're all, in this case, hydrocarbons. Well, hydrocarbons are important organic compounds, but there's plenty of other organic compounds that are not hydrocarbons, especially in biology. Bringing us to six. Six is an example of an important organic molecule found in organisms. This is a fat molecule, as you can see. In a different chapter, we'll talk much more about fat and the fact that it has different names other than fat. You can call it a triglyceride or a triacylglycerol, but fat is the easiest to say and spell. What you see here, though, is in a single fat molecule, there are three yellow highlighted tails. These tails are, if they were by themselves and not connected to the rest, they were just on their own, they would be called fatty acids. So a single fat molecule has three fatty acids in it. But the part that is highlighted in yellow just one fatty acid. If you ignore this end of it, just the part that's highlighted in yellow, if you imagine that by itself, what would you classify that as, molecularly speaking? What is it? Based on what it's made of. No. The whole thing is nothing but carbons and hydrogens, right? Except for this end. I'm telling you to ignore that end. If it weren't for this end, then a fatty acid would be a hydrocarbon. And I already told you that hydrocarbons in general make good fuels, right? That's one of the major functions of fat, to store energy for organisms. Fats have a very high energy density. The energy density of a nutrient is how much energy is contained in a gram of that stuff. Well, there's more than twice as much energy in a gram of fat than there is in a gram of carbohydrate or a gram of protein. And this is why no matter what we take in, whether it's fat that we take in or any other nutrient that we take in, if we're taking in more than we need for the energy demands of our body based on our exercise and our metabolism, then we store it in the form of fat. Because fat with that high nutrient density means we don't need as much of it. If we stored our extra calories or extra energy as proteins or as carbohydrate, we would have to weigh a lot more because we would have to use a lot more of that stuff to contain the same amount of energy. So it's a more efficient way of storing it. The fact that hydrocarbons are nonpolar, though, means fats, the fatty acid tails of fats, don't like to be around water. And this is why things like oils, which are fats, don't mix well with water. All right, now to 7. Well, speaking of isomers, which we've just generally discussed, what we see in this slide is that there are these three major ways, there's more than this actually, but in this course, three major ways to classify isomers. Not all isomers are isomers for the same reason. And so on the top, we see examples of structural isomers. In each of these three boxes, the one in the left of the box and the one on the right of the box are isomers of each other. Each pair has exactly the same chemical formula. But in the structural isomers category, they are structural isomers simply because the carbon skeleton is arranged differently. Right? In this case, one is linear, one is branched. That's fairly easy to understand. In the middle, though, we have geometric isomers. Now notice in the structural isomers, those are alkanes. There's only single bonds. Geometric isomers arise when you have double bonds. So think back to your molecular modeling exercise. If you build an alkane, which you did, for instance, methane you built, but anything that has only single bonds, whether it's a hydrocarbon or not, you can use any atoms you want. If it's nothing but single bonds, then you can spin all of those wooden sticks, right? You can swivel things on the stick, so it doesn't have to stay in place. But think about a pair of springs that you use to represent a double bond. You can't swivel those, right? You can a little bit, but it has to stay in place. So if you have a double bond between carbons in a skeleton, then the things connected to that carbon have to stay in one position or another based on how that bond was formed originally. And so you have two versions of isomers in that case, cis and trans. Cis means same side, trans means across or opposite side. Same prefaces that we use nowadays for genders, right? Cisgender and transgender. But notice that X, which represents anything you want other than hydrogen here, those are on the same side. So this is the cis version. Now they're on opposite sides of the double bond, so that's the trans version of the isomer. Subtle difference, but they act differently with other things, so they are separate substances. They are isomers. And the bottom category is enantiomers. Enantiomers are examples of chiral compounds. We say they are chiral compounds, or they have chirality. Chirality refers to handedness, having handedness. Chiro, as a prefix, means hand. For instance, a chiropractor, someone who works on you with his or her hands. Chiromancer is a person who casts spells with his hands. Chiroptera means hand wing. That's what bats are called, chiropterans. Anyway, handedness of molecules is just like handedness of your body. Your right and left hand seem very, very similar to each other. But if you were able to remove them without hurting yourself and play around with them, there's no way you could take your right hand and just position it differently in space and make it be just like your left hand. They're mirror images of each other. They're not the same thing, right? Similarly, if you have a carbon atom forming four single bonds, and it's forming bonds with four different things, it doesn't matter what they are, as long as they're four different things at the corners of the tetrahedron, and you make that model, there's no way that you can turn it around in space and make the mirror image. To make the mirror image, you would have to take it partially apart, break two bonds, and replace them, switch them around. Okay? So these are distinct molecules, distinct substances that are mirror images of each other. So we say they're chiral because there is a left-handed version and a right-handed version. And which version you have makes a difference chemically, as you can see in slide 8. The chiral compounds we're using as examples here happen to both be drugs, ibuprofen and albuterol. Remember that drugs are just exogenous signals. Any chemical signals will have no effect at all, remember, unless and until the chemical signal binds to a receptor. That's what actually causes the change, or starts the chain of events that results in change. There has to be binding of the, this case, drug as a signal to a receptor. Well, these are chiral compounds. So for each of these two drugs, there's a right-handed version and a left-handed version that you can produce. But only one of them works in the body because the body has either a right-handed receptor or a left-handed receptor, depending on the drug. And that's where you have these S and R notations. Just one of a few different standards that we use for chiral compounds. S is short for sinistro. Or if you use the entire word, it would be sinistrol. Meaning left-handed. There's the majority of humans are right-handed, and we have dumped on left-handers in various ways throughout history. One is the word sinister, which means left-handed. We say that person is suspicious, sinister. It's acting like a person who is left-handed, which is kind of a raw deal for the lefties of the world. But that's what the S stands for. The R is from recto, which means right, like in rectangle made of right angles. For ibuprofen, what you can see by this table, though, is that it's on a drug-by-drug basis as to whether the right-handed version or the left-handed version works. For ibuprofen, the effective one, the one that does work, is the left-handed version. You give the right-handed version, it's a waste of money producing that because we don't have the right-handed version of the receptor. So it's like a hand in a glove, right? And I'm talking about not surgical gloves, which don't have handedness, but real thick gloves. You can tell you have the wrong glove on if you put your right hand in the left glove. But for albuterol, it's the right-handed version that works, the left-handed version that doesn't work. Same thing is shown in slide 9 using the two versions of DOPA, L-DOPA and D-DOPA. This is not SNR. Like I said, there's multiple standards we've used. L is short for levo, which means left. D is short for dextro, which means right. This is another way we dump on left-handers. The word dextrous literally means right-handed. We use it to mean working well with your hands, right? And the word ambidextrous literally means having two right hands, as though you can't work well with a left hand. But anyway, that's what the D stands for. And it is ineffective. L-DOPA is the effective stuff in this case. Okay, now to 10. Estradiol and testosterone are two hormones. Estradiol is an estrogen. These are two drastically different hormones in their effects, right? Estrogens are feminizing hormones. Testosterone is masculizing. So drastically different effects. But see how similar they are. And in fact, they both start out as exactly the same thing, which is a very similar molecule as well, which is cholesterol. All of the steroid hormones in animals start out as cholesterol that just gets slightly modified to form these different steroids. Despite being very similar, they have drastic different effects, though, because of these little shaded in blue pieces of the molecule that are functional groups that you started learning about last week in lab. And I told you all you had to know those. We're going to go through them in a minute. But functional groups are not complete molecules, right? They are just a collection of atoms in a certain arrangement that are part of a bigger molecule, but they give that overall molecule certain functions because of that particular arrangement. That's why they're called functional groups. Let's then look at the major ones you have to know in these final two slides, 11 and 12. Starting with slide 11, each of these has the name of the functional group, a little cartoon of the ball and stick, the symbol, and then some other information. But keep in mind that each of these ball and sticks is not a complete molecule, right? That's why it has a stick hanging off of it. That's not complete. It has to just be part of a molecule for it to form a complete molecule. Hydroxyl, though, is the first. And at this point, you should already know these anyway, so we can kind of go through this quickly, which we have to anyway. Hydroxyl is an OH. Now, you can write this one just writes it as dash OH. You could also write it as R dash OH. R stands for residue, which just means the rest of the molecule, whatever it is. And it doesn't matter whether the R is on the right or the left. You could also write this as HO dash or HO dash R. But you can't write it as OH-R. What's wrong with this? What is it? But why is that a problem? Well, this is never going to happen. Why? What's the valence of hydrogen? How many bonds is it making here?
Two.
Impossible, right? The hydrogen has to be making only one bond. It's the oxygen that's making two. Okay, but anyway, anything that there's hydroxyls in a lot of different compounds. Any given compound that contains a hydroxyl is, by definition, an alcohol. We call hydroxyl-containing compounds alcohols. Now, ethanol is the alcohol in all alcoholic beverages, whether it's beer, wine, or spirits. But there's all different kinds of alcohols, anything with a hydroxyl, including monosaccharides. Sugars are alcohols as well. Anyway, they're important in biology for many reasons. But the OH, just like the OH that's part of water, makes it polar because O and H have drastically different electronegativities. So that's biologically significant. The next one up is carbonyl, which, as you can see, is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. Now, carbon has to make four bonds, so there's two unmet bonds here, two connection points it has to make with the rest of the molecule. And because of that, there's two possible ways that this can happen. You can see the two ways in the two example substances in the middle. One of those ways is for the carbon that's part of the carbonyl, the C double bond O, for that carbon to be at the tip of a carbon skeleton. By tip, I mean any tip, because if it's branching, there's a lot of tips, maybe. But any tip, that's one possibility. The other possibility is it's not at a tip. Here it happens to be right in the middle, but anywhere other than a tip is the other possibility. And therefore, there isn't just one category of carbonyl-containing compounds. There's two categories, which are called ketones and aldehydes. And I remember I used to struggle remembering which was which until it finally dawned on me one day, and hopefully this will help you, that the word aldehyde starts with an A, which is at a tip of the alphabet. And so aldehydes have the carbonyl at a tip. K, on the other hand, is in the middle of the alphabet. Ketones have the carbonyl not at a tip. Right? Carboxyl is next, and that's the one that confuses people when they do the modeling lab, especially now that we do it before we actually learn it in here. Because it looks like you have a carbonyl group here and also a hydroxyl group. And technically you do, but when you have the two together in exactly this configuration, we don't consider this to be a carbonyl or a hydroxyl group. Instead, the overall functional group is carboxyl. But notice that the word carboxyl is really just a portmanteau or combination of the two words carbonyl and hydroxyl. But it's not considered either of those individual functional groups. It is a carboxyl. And carboxyls are really important in biology because they form, well, the category of carboxyl-containing compounds is carboxylic acids, which are important for various reasons. But in biology, every amino acid, which as we'll see are the building blocks of proteins, has a carboxyl. So you can't have any proteins without carboxyl groups. It's impossible to consider life without carboxyls. Next and final slide is 12. Next up, though, in functional groups is the amino group. And whenever you see amino, amono, amine, words like that or prefixes like that, you know you're dealing with a nitrogen somewhere. They mean nitrogen. You can see that the amino group is a nitrogen bonded singly to two hydrogens and then also bonded to the rest of the molecule. Well, these are also indispensable to life for the same reason that carboxyls are. I mentioned that carboxyls are parts of amino acids. Well, every amino acid also has an amino group. Every amino acid has an amino group and a carboxyl group, which is why we call them amino acids. The acid part comes from the carboxylic acid. The amino part of the name, of course, comes from the fact that it contains an amino group. So glycine here, this is one amino acid. You can see the highlighted part is the amino group. This part on the other side is the carboxyl group. And the 20 different amino acids that organisms use to make their thousands of different proteins, each one of those contains both of these functional groups. So very important to life. Sulfhydryl is next. SH instead of OH. Now it shouldn't surprise you that SH can form just like OH. Why should that not surprise you? Well, look at the periodic table. And think back to what you did in the lab. Yes, they're in the same group, so they have the same valence. Same number of holes in their models, right? So an SH can form just like OH can form. And remember what we called hydroxyl-containing compounds, OH-containing compounds. What were those? Propane. Hydroxyl-containing compounds are called what? You learned this about 4 minutes ago. Alcohols, yes. And alcohols, there's many different alcohols, but their names individually end in OL to tell you they're alcohols, like ethanol, the alcohol in alcoholic beverages. Cholesterol is an alcohol as well, ends in OL. Well, these are like alcohols, but they're not, because it's not a hydroxyl, it's a sulfhydryl, right? So we call them thiols instead, which literally means sulfur alcohol, because the thio part means sulfur. They're not actually alcohols, but they act kind of like alcohols because of the similarity of properties between sulfur and oxygen. Okay, so whenever you see thio, you know you're in, there's a sulfur involved somewhere. Okay, and sulfhydryl groups are found in certain amino acids that make up proteins. And as we'll discuss later, this can make two groups that have sulfhydryl groups to come together and form a covalent bond between them, which is really stabilizes the shape of the protein. Phosphate is next. This is the most complex of them in terms of atoms. A phosphorus atom, which is what the P is, surrounded by four oxygen atoms, one of which is connected to the rest of the skeleton. And there's at least three major reasons why we can't exist without phosphate. One is that phosphate is a component of every nucleotide, which is the building blocks that DNA and RNA are made out of. You can't have any DNA or RNA without phosphate. You also can't have any ATP, which is the major energy-carrying compound in all cells. And you also can't phosphorylate or dephosphorylate proteins to turn them on or off. So truly important stuff. And then finally is methyl. And CH3 with the C also bonded to the carbon skeleton. And you find these in a lot of compounds because whenever you have a C at a tip, if it's only making a single bond with the rest of the skeleton and it still has three bonds it has to make, and the simplest way is to just fill it up with three hydrogens. So you find methyls all over the place. But they also can be used as switches, in a sense. You can methylate and demethylate DNA to either turn genes on or turn genes off so that they won't be used for a while. And that's perfect timing. So come armed with knowledge of all four chapters and a Scantron on Monday.